The term women's liberation does not get used much anymore. It's about 50 years out of date. But we still live in a society where it makes news when a woman takes a certain job for the first time. We have the first woman vice president, for example, and that started only 4 months ago. We'll focus on women lawyers in this hour, and a step further, women teaching other lawyers in law schools. It's been barely more than a century since a woman first took a tenure-track faculty position at an accredited law school. The story is told by Herma K. Hill with an edit from Patricia Kane in the book Paving the Way, The First American Women Law Professors. Herma Hill K. Was the former dean at the UC Berkeley School of Law and one-time president of the Association of American Law Schools. She died in 2017, and the book was finished by Patricia Kane as editor. She teaches law at Santa Clara University and at the University of Iowa. Patricia Kane, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I'm a little surprised. Am I wrong to be surprised that Herma Hill K. was only the 15th person in the group?
Well, not surprisingly. I mean, I went to law school myself in the early 70s, and I say when the University of Texas first hired me, I'd never seen a woman law professor. I didn't know they existed.
Wow.
Women did not, were not students until really mid-70s into the 80s, and women started being hired in larger numbers in the 1970s. So it's not surprising. There were only 14 women law professors at accredited. I mean, there were women who taught law at other law schools, but Herma confined her list to those who taught at ABA accredited law schools, who were also members of the Association of American Law Schools. And that limited the list a bit, but there were only 14 before Herma. Everybody says, why is the book only about 14? And I say, it's because Herma was number 15, and she did not want to write about herself.
It's all right. So this is not a biography. This is interesting. But we'll get to the actual how you got to be the editor of this project mm-hmm. in a moment. I want to ask about that qualifier, though. Herma insisting that we're talking not only tenure track, but also accredited school, accredited by ABA and AALS. Mm-hmm. Does that narrow a much bigger field or just a slightly larger one?
Well, it narrows the field a bit because it actually cuts out a very important early woman, the first black woman law professor, who started at North Carolina Central in the 1950s, and who was a graduate of the University of Chicago, which is also sort of amazing in those days. But even though the school was ABA accredited, it was not a member of the Association of American Law Schools at that time. And I think Herma made the limitation because there she had clear records. You know, the Association of American Law Schools puts out a directory every year and lists all the women law professors along with everyone else. And so she had much clearer records about who really counted. But she also cut out people who were full-time librarians, even if they were tenure track. So there are a number of early women that I remember from my early days going to Association of American Law Schools meetings, AALS we call it, who were tenured even. The first tenured woman at Connecticut, for example, was a librarian. And so her story is not included in the book.
Now, I understand Herma ended up at Berkeley in part because she was denied a prestigious clerkship. Who did she want to clerk for and got basically the cold shoulder?
Well, no woman had clerked at the United States Supreme Court by 1960. In fact, it wasn't until the 1970s that someone, Justice Douglas, actually hired a female law clerk. Herma was clerking for Roger Traynor, who was on the Supreme Court in California, and was kind of a pipeline. Usually his clerks would go directly to Chief Justice Earl Warren on the Supreme Court. And even though he called and said, you know, and she's wonderful, you should take her, but Earl Warren, along with all the other justices, said, no, not a woman.
Interesting. Interesting, considering all the things that are thought about Earl Warren now and how progressive or liberal he was, and yet not on that particular part of it. And
but I mean, he was in the company of other liberal progressive justices who said no to women.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Herma Hill Kay didn't want to write a book about herself. She did ask you to write a biography of her, but this isn't it. How did you get chosen to finish this work?
I think because of that offer to write the biography. So for the last few years of her life, and she made me promise that I would not write or publish anything about her until her book had come out. Mm. So that was like kind of a precondition. And so for the last few years of her life, I mean, I wasn't a student of hers. I met her in the 1970s when I first started teaching at the University of Texas. And, you know, she became, because there were so few women law professors and because I met her on a trip to California in the 70s, she did serve as a mentor. I mean, we talked by phone. You had to have women contacts around the country to talk to by phone because there was usually only one woman on a law school faculty in those days. I don't know. I asked her. I was at an ALI meeting, the American Law Institute, and we were having after-dinner drinks, and I just said, so who's going to write your story? And she just looked at me and said, how about you? Huh. I thought, oh, well, okay, I don't think I say no to that, but I thought, why me? And then I think I probably mentioned this in the press. It's back in the 70s, I was kind of brash and daring, and I had composed a kind of silly song about a feminist law world, you know, in which Herma became the dean at Harvard and Ruth Bader Ginsburg became Chief Justice.
Hold the thought, Patricia. We got a break coming up. We'll pick up the story on the other side of a break. Paving the Way is the book. We're back with Patricia Cain in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We're talking about women law professors, the first 14 in the country who are both tenure track and at a law school accredited by ABA and the American Association, the Association of American Law Schools. The 14 women are profiled in a book called Paving the Way, the First American Women Law Professors. It was begun and largely written by Herma Hill Kay, who would have been number 15 on that list, by the way. Instead, it was finished after her death 4 years ago by Patricia Cain, who is the teaches law at Santa Clara University and the University of Iowa. If you've got questions or comments or things to share about women becoming law school professors, not just lawyers, but law school professors, join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So to pick up the story, you weren't a student of Herma's, but you got to set up basically a talent show of law students?
Well, it was for the Association of American Law Schools. They used to, at their annual meeting, have something they'd called the Faculty Follies or some such thing, in which law professors entertained each other. And the person who was the deputy director that year had thought that as a law school student of his, I had done this beautiful job of putting on something called the Libel Show that the
Sorry, we dropped out. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. What?
There was a bit of a glitch in the phone there for a second, but you're back.
Okay, good. Anyway, he called me and said, would I put together the show? And so I called law professors around the country and got them to, you know, sing with their guitar or whatever talent they had. And then I thought, if I'm gonna arrange this, I probably need to do something myself. So I wrote a song and sang it for the group, and it was it was a feminist spoof on law schools that didn't hire women, and now suddenly, Terma took over Harvard. As I say in the song, she started a national coup, and every law school who wanted to be like Harvard, of course, had to hire more women law professors. And I think she thought that was bold, and she was kind of a bold person in her own way. I mean, she had a pilot's license. She drove a little yellow Jaguar. She, she was the first woman a lot of things, and she was always a champion of women. She's a perfect person to write this book.
Well, and the line in the song that you include in the book is that when Herma Kay, in the song context, in fictional world, then took over Harvard Law School, she fired the men, hired women law professors, was challenged in the courts, but they couldn't get anywhere because, and the words to the song, President Bella Abzug had put Ruth Bader Ginsburg in Berger's chair.
Yep.
Warren Berger, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So, wow. So, but obviously, Ruth Bader Ginsburg did make it to the Supreme Court and wrote a foreword to the book before her death. How well did she and Herma know each other?
Oh, they knew each other very well. They, they met. Excuse me. Let me have a swallow of water here. They met another swallow. They met in 1971 at a very early Women and the Law Conference. They were both interested in sex discrimination in the law, of course. Herma was working on a manuscript that became a book, and Ruth was out litigating in the courts. And they got together and ended up co-authoring the first major book on sex discrimination in the law. And they remained close friends throughout their careers, even though they were on different coasts. Ruth actually is the force behind this book. Once Herma died, I mean, she kept pushing that this book had to be published. And I'm not sure, without her support, whether or not I would have talked to University of California Press into publishing it. But every time Ruth was giving a speech, whether she gave one at Berkeley, she was always on the program at the Association of American Law Schools or the American Law Institute. Almost every time she was given a microphone, she would say, "This is a book that has to be published." Mm-hmm. That got attention.
Yeah, it really did. It really. So it's great that she was able to write the foreword for it herself before her own death. So go ahead.
Yeah, her death was very untimely. I had so wanted to be able to hand her a copy of this book. I was able to send her an email a week before her death. I'm told she got it that said it had been finally approved by the Faculty Review Committee and would be published within the next few months.
Oh, good. So she got to lay her hands on a copy of it, we hope, before her own death. We are talking to Patricia Kane, who is the editor of Paving the Way, the first American women law professors, largely written by Herma Hill Kay before her death in 2017. Number one on the list, Barbara Nachtrieb Armstrong. Where was she from? Where did she learn law herself?
Well, she was the first woman law professor in the country. She started teaching in 1919, which is an amazingly long time ago in my mind. And she was the first woman at Bolt, Bolt Hall, which is now Berkeley Law, which is why Herma was the second woman. So it's another reason that Herma is perfect for writing this book, because Barbara Armstrong was, of course, a mentor herself to Herma since they were at the same school. And Barbara is interesting. I mean, she was interested in theater. She apparently was a very, very good actress. It's rumored that Cecil B. DeMille was actually trying to put her under contract, so it's a question of whether she would go into the movies or instead go into law, and fortunately for all of us, she went into law. Her big passion was social economics. I mean, it was, public health. I mean, if she'd had her way, California today would have basically Medicare for all. She was a firm believer in public insurance programs for health and retirement. I mean, she was recruited by FDR to come work in his administration and is one of the major movers behind what we now know as the Social Security Act of the 1930s.
And fought very hard for it, apparently. The description in the book is that Armstrong was definitely not a person to back down from a fight.
That's correct. I mean, a lot of people think of Perkins, the woman who was head of labor then, as, you know, the woman behind Social Security. But she and Barbara Armstrong actually disagreed on some issues, and Armstrong stood her stead and got what she wanted.
So there were only two other women law professors before World War II, it appears, and they get a chapter by Harriet Daggett and Margaret Amsler. I'm reminded as their stories unfold in the book how much more women had to do just to be considered as good as men in the same jobs.
Yeah, I mean, all of the early women were truly exceptional in their own way. And another reason Herman was the perfect person to write this book is because the second woman you just mentioned, Margaret Amsler, taught at Baylor, in Waco, Texas. And Herma went to SMU, Southern Methodist University, for her undergraduate before she went to Chicago Law School, where she met the next woman law professor, Sonia Menchikoff, who was teaching there. But it turns out one of her classmates at SMU was the daughter of Margaret Amsler. And so Herma's mother, who did not want her to go to law school, she said, women can't make a living. Get a teaching certificate, do something where you can support yourself. But Margaret Amsler was there to encourage her, say, look at me. Yes, you can do it. And that was another early connection that was important.
So she had a role in Herma Hill K going to law school, but before that, herself, before she even, I guess before she got a faculty position, she was in the Texas State Legislature, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Now, she's also aided by the fact that she had a father who was a professor of law at Baylor, so she kind of had a foot in the door, so to speak. But all these women had trouble getting jobs as lawyers. So getting elected to the legislature was in some ways easier than getting a job as a lawyer unless you were going to practice with your father.
Oh, wow. So it's interesting. A couple of things that I want to bring up here about Margaret and Harris Amsler was that she played a role in the passage of something like an Equal Rights Amendment in Texas, but not the way you might think.
Well, yeah, I mean, she was actually opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment. This is, there was a woman named Hermine Tablaski, whom I started my career in Texas, so I know all this history of the strong women in Texas. Amsler was actually opposed to the Equal Rights Amendment in that she didn't think it was needed. She thought it was necessary to make the laws themselves support women, and she was instrumental in getting some of Texas's community property laws changed in such a way that women were actually given some power over property. And because of that, she didn't think that the Equal Rights Amendment was necessary. I don't think she was opposed to it once it was actually passed, but she was not a champion of it the way Hermine Tablaski was.
And in neighboring Louisiana, that's where Harriet Daggett did her work at LSU. Obviously, the Deep South, not long ago. I mean, where did she come down on integrating the law school?
Well, that's the other interesting story. You picked out so many wonderful little bits in this book. It's interesting, too. I mean, the number two and number three were both in the South, at LSU and at Baylor in Texas. I grew up in the South, and of course, when I went to Austin, I didn't think it was the South at all. I thought it was the beginning of the West because it was so different from Georgia. But to think that that Harriet Daggett, who was also known by her students as Ma Daggett, I think because she taught two of her sons in law school when she got that kind of nominer, but she was a strong supporter of integration, and so there was a big push, after Sweat v. Painter, the Texas case that said you could not. You could not run a segregated law school. That it was a case of separate was certainly not equal. You couldn't set up a law school for one black person and have it compete with the University of Texas. After that happened, the Association of American Law Schools was very involved in trying to put together support for ending segregation in all law schools. And so there was a resolution that came up before an annual meeting. And Daggett was a key proponent of passing that resolution. And it's one of the reasons that LSU, even though it was in the South, Tulane was different. Tulane voted against the resolution, but LSU voted for it. And so she stands as a champion of integration.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. Our guest is Patricia Kane, who is a law professor herself, teaching at Santa Clara University and the University of Iowa. She is the editor of a book started by Herma Hill Kay, who was the 15th tenure-track woman law professor at an accredited school, accredited by ABA and the Association of American Law Schools. She wrote Paving the Way, the First American Women Law Professors. Herma Hill Kay died in 2017. Patricia Kane brought the book across the finish line. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about women law professors and women getting into professions that were generally closed to them for a very long time. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Patricia, you already mentioned Soya Menchikoff in passing, and this is a major figure we'd run across before, actually, because she'd been mentioned as a possible first woman Supreme Court justice on a first couple of short lists. Yep. She truly came a long way to go to law school. Where'd she come from?
From Russia.
Wow.
Yeah, she is deservedly in a chapter all by herself. Some people called her the Tsarina of legal education. Most people say things like she was the first woman everything, but she really wasn't. She wasn't the first woman law professor. She was the first woman to be the president of the Association of American Law Schools, and she ultimately became a dean at the University of Miami. She was not the first woman dean either, but she's so impressive. I mean, it's interesting. I just got an email from someone who had contributed to the story of Soya, who knew her at Chicago and also at Miami, and he said he just read the book and the chapter on Soya, and he said it's a fair and accurate portrayal, but I realize it's probably impossible to convey the full measure of this woman. It would take a poet or a novelist to make real for others the combination of intellect, physicality, earthiness, and charm that Soya held for both women and men alike. I thought Herma kind of summed it up pretty well when she quoted Carl Llewellyn, Soya's husband, in the end of the chapter, saying, "My gal can sail ships."
I sort of detected a certain level of cackling when I mentioned that that Soya had been shortlisted for the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah, that's because she absolutely refused. She didn't want to be known as the first woman anything. She didn't want to be the first woman justice on the Supreme Court. If she wasn't entitled to it as her rightfulness as a person, she wasn't interested.
She was the first woman president, I notice, of AALS, the Association of American Law Schools.
Yep.
So how big a force was she in getting other women on law faculty?
Actually, not a force at all. It's interesting, she ended up as dean at Miami, and during this period of the first 14 women, Miami at one time, you know, had three women, including Soya, on their faculty, which was unheard of and certainly broke the record of any other law school. But Soya didn't hire those women, and Soya, even herself in public, said she thought it was wrong to go out and try to look for women, because you might get someone that was not quite really that good, and if she didn't make it, then it would be harder to hire the next woman. So Soya was not loved by a number of law professors, women law professors, who came along in the 70s and were hired, I think, as affirmative action hires. I mean, I was told by one of my colleagues at Texas, you know, the only reason we hired you is because you're a woman. It was 1972 was when they finally opened up federal laws to protect higher education and in hiring of women, and so there was pressure from the federal government on law school faculties around the country. They didn't have any women to hire them. as my dear departed friend Barbara Babcock said, it opened a window of affirmative action for at least one woman on each law faculty.
Hmm. So how does that feel, though, when you've been told, oh, you're an affirmative action hire? I mean, how did you use that in your own career?
Yeah, I will cite Barbara Babcock's other famous line. She was hired in the 1950s. She was hired by Stanford in the early 70s, but then was also hired by Jimmy Carter as the first woman to head the civil division at Justice. And she was asked by a reporter, so how does it feel to know that you have this post only because you're a woman? And she said, it feels a hell of a lot better than not getting it because I'm a woman.
Yeah, there's a certain logic there, isn't there?
Oh, yep. Wow.
So, Soya Menchikov, are you, as at University of Chicago, so Chicago and the University of Miami, is there, those are two major places?
Yeah, she started teaching at, well, the story, she was actually the first woman to ever teach at Harvard. She taught there as a visitor, and they wanted to hire her permanently. But by that time, she was a partner, then spouse of Carl Llewellyn. They would have had to hire both. And Carl Llewellyn is famous in his own right for many things, but he was apparently not well loved by the students at Harvard. And so I think he had a drinking problem, and that's discussed in the book. Mm-hmm. And so Harvard was willing to hire Soya, but not him. And this is before Harvard even admitted women as students.
Wow.
So it's kind of amazing that she actually taught there. And then the solution to it all was Chicago. Chicago decided even though they had an anti-nepotism rule,
okay,
they could hire both of them.
All right, back after a break. Paving the Way, the first American women law professor, is back in the exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about women law professors with one. Patricia Kane is the editor of a book called Paving the Way, the First American Women Law Professors. It was the work of Herma Hill Kay, herself a law professor, number 15 in the list of women who were both tenure track and at law schools accredited by the American Bar Association and the Association of American Law Schools. So she wrote a book about the 14 who came before her. She died in 2017. Patricia Kane from the Santa Clara University and the University of Iowa finished the book as the editor and is our guest on the exchange. And you can join in the conversation about women in law faculty. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So in a clump, we get five women who had been law librarians: Miriam Teresa Rooney, Jeanette Ozanne Smith, Janet Mary Riley, I'm sure she's related, Helen Elsie Steinbinder, and Maria Minette Massey. Was law librarian as high as many women could get in a law school for a long time?
Well, I think that there were certainly more women who were librarians, law librarians, than otherwise. I mean, all of these women started because they were either a librarian at some public place other than a university. I mean, they took a degree. They had a background in librarianship. And then they also got a JD. And so the two combined made them prime, you know, candidates for what they did. Now, I mean, the first one you mentioned, I mean, Miriam Rooney, was also the founding dean. She is the first woman dean. She's the founding dean of Seton Hall Law School. She actually was responsible for its creation. And so she's much more than a librarian turned teacher. And it, you know, my favorite story about Jeanette Smith is that she had a son. She used to sing him as a lullaby in Savannah. Hard-hearted Hannah, vamp from Savannah. not exactly a lullaby in my mind, but,
no.
But kind of interesting. And Minette Nancy, I actually met her once when I was on a psych team reviewing the University of Miami Law School for the ALS, and I met her. She was still alive and teaching in those days, and you know these were all amazing women. You know, the hardest thing about this book was getting photographs.
Mm-hmm. Really?
I thought it would be simple. I mean, the press told me, you get the photographs, we'll put them on the cover, we'll put them in the book. And I thought it would be really easy because these are all important women. So the law school that they started at will certainly have photographs of them. Well, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, there just weren't as many photographs. So to get usable, high-quality photographs was really one of the biggest tasks of this book. And Georgetown, I mean, where Helen Steinbinder started, they had one photograph.
Yeah, I noticed as I was looking for pictures of Barbara Nocturne Armstrong from her acting career that mm-hmm. there weren't many of those out there either. So
no,
just not a lot of.
No, I had very much wanted to get a picture of her playing Cleopatra. I thought that would be fun. But instead, I did find at least a youthful picture of her, which was back in the day. So I thought it was close. Mm-hmm. My other favorite photo in the book, it's not on the cover, because it was Patricia Roberts Harris, who was one of the first black law professors. Not the first, but... Well, the first at an ABA ALS accredited law school, mm-hmm. and the photo I got of her is her on a postage stamp.
Not terribly helpful, huh?
I mean, because you know she was in federal government and she was a secretary in the cabinet and was one of the prominent black American lawyers of her time.
You know, I haven't asked so far, but I mean, how much less were these women law school faculty members paid than men?
Oh, in a number of cases, pretty regularly. And when they discovered that, some of them were rash enough to bring it up, and it was usually corrected. But, you know, the discrimination in those days, I mean, a man was thought to have a family to take care of, so of course he had to have more money.
Oh.
This is even true. And my father, who was a lawyer in Georgia in the 1950s, he was paid more than another male lawyer in his firm because he, my father, had a family to support, and the other man was single.
Oh.
So that's just kind of the thinking that went on in those days.
In addition to the pay differential, let's talk about working conditions, because how much grief did women law professors have to put up with from male students?
Not a lot, actually. I mean, what's amazing to me is all of these women say that they did not experience sex discrimination. And I think by that they mean they were hired and they didn't experience sex discrimination in the hiring. And they all ultimately got tenure and they didn't really, some of them took a little bit longer. I mean, Margot Melly from Wisconsin was going to take even longer because she was trying to work part-time so she could raise a family. And they finally adjusted that and realized you don't ever really work part-time in a law school if you're on the tenure track.
Right.
If you say you're half-time, you're probably working about 80% of the time because of all the extra duties that fall upon you. But I don't think they really experienced any bad experience from the male students. I mean, I think, which is interesting. I mean, Other than maybe Joan Kroskopf. I mean, she didn't experience bad discrimination from law students, but she was hired originally by Ohio State, but was married to a man who then moved to Colorado. She moved with him. That's what women did in those days. Wherever the man went, the woman went, and Colorado wouldn't hire her. I mean, those are the days when you just said, no, over my dead body, am I going to hire a woman to be on this faculty? Wow. And then she went to Missouri with her husband, and she taught forever as a visitor, as an adjunct, and all kinds of, and was loved by the students, but couldn't get on the tenure track. So she finally walked up to Wash U, which is in St. Louis, and said, you know what, I really want to be on the tenure track. And Wash U told her, you're so good that if you want to join our faculty, we will hire you with tenure. So she took that offer back to Missouri and ended up finally being the first woman on their faculty.
Wow. So Joan Kroskopf and Margot Melle are grouped together in a chapter called The End of an Era. What makes them the end of an era?
Well, they're the two right before Herma. And the interesting one about Margot, whom I also know because I taught as a visitor at Wisconsin once in the 70s, Margot almost didn't make the list because she was hired in 1959 by the University of Wisconsin, but because she and her husband wanted to adopt a child, she was told by the adoption agency, we will not place a child and family where the woman is working full time. So she had to go into the University of Wisconsin and say, I'm going to resign. I want to adopt the child. I can come back, but I'll have to resign for right now. And so she was removed from the ALS directory, and then when she reentered in 60 or 61, she was reentered, and it took some digging on Herma's part to understand that she was actually hired in 1959, a year before Herma was hired at Bolt.
Oh, that's right. So that's right. Herma was walking around thinking there were 13 women who preceded her, and there actually were 14, including Margot Melle, because Margot Melle had to quit just to be able to adopt the child.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So little pieces of discrimination. I mean, the other bit of discrimination is from Ellen Ash Peters at Yale, who mentioned that, you know, for the longest time she was the only woman on the faculty, and then she noticed, she was actually somewhat amazed, when other women joined the faculty and they went to faculty meetings, it was like there were more than one of us in the room and they actually heard us. You know, you weren't suddenly the only... I had this experience at Texas, you know, you'd say something at a faculty meeting and they'd just go right over it, and 10 minutes later some man would say exactly the same thing, and he would get noticed. Oh, good point, Joe. Even though I've made the point, you know, 10 minutes earlier, and when I was joined by a second woman named Barbara Aldavi, we used to say, okay, let's just reinforce each other at faculty meetings. As Barbara said, or as Pat said, and it made all the difference in the world.
Well, I'm laughing now, but it, you know, it's just because it seems like ancient history, but it's really not. And I wonder at what point. I mean, do most law school faculties have a pretty good mix of men and women?
Oh yeah, I mean it's totally changed now. It started changing in the 70s when every law school hired one woman, but then women applicants to law schools increased. So, you know, when I went to law school, I was like one of 16 in a class of 240. The class before me had only two women in it.
Wow.
And so there weren't a lot of people in the pipeline to become law professors because there weren't a lot of law students. And there was a lot of self-selection going on in those days. I mean, women who applied to law school were people who, you know, had been outstanding students or had aced to the LSAT or done something that made them think that they were capable of going to law school. And compared to men who thought, well, I'm a man, I'm going to go to law school, their credentials really did. I mean, I was on the admissions committee for a long time at Texas. The women's credentials outweighed the men tremendously until there were more significant women in law schools, and then more started applying. And it made, and this is why we call the book Paving the Way. I mean, the first 14 women were symbolic. They were there. It's like we stand on their shoulders. They made it possible.
So was, for example, the law school experience of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who again has a foreword in this book, was it a bit different from women of previous generations?
Well, I mean, if you've seen the movie or heard the story of her life, I mean, you know the story of she was in one of the early classes at Harvard. Harvard had just begun to admit women. And there's this very memorable story of Dean Griswold hosting all the nine women students, and then going around the room and asking them, "And what makes you think that you deserve to be here, taking the place of an otherwise qualified man?"
Oh boy. Well, that doesn't happen anymore, does it?
No, that doesn't happen anymore. Yeah,
right.
For the first time, I mean, when I was at Texas, I could always count the number of women on the faculty on one hand.
Mm-hmm.
I moved to Iowa in 1991, and we were a significant part of the faculty, but I could still name everyone and count them. By the time I got to Santa Clara in 2007, I don't even know how many women are on the faculty. I mean, we could be over half for all I know.
So are there some places left, though? Are there some pockets of resistance or something where things still lag a bit behind the times?
Not so much anymore. I think by the end of the 1900s, Texas had a reputation for not hiring women, but I think it's gotten beyond that now. Although there's a woman who's filed a sex discrimination suit against them, so they're not totally out of the woods yet. And Berkeley was not great in granting tenure to women. I mean, it had Herman, and then it hired a Babette Barton, and they were fine. But the next few women they hired had real tenure battles, and that were proved to be sex discrimination, actually. So they ended up on the faculties, but it was still hard. But that was the 70s or early 80s. I think things are much better now.
Mm-hmm. One name we haven't mentioned yet, Dorothy Wright Nelson. She's in a chapter with Ellen Ash Peters,
yep,
who you did mention. And what was she known for?
Well, Dorothy Wright Nelson became the dean at USC. She was the first woman on the faculty at University of Southern California. Have a connection with her too because I taught at USC for 2 years and mm-hmm. met her at an event there. But she also was then appointed to the Ninth Circuit, so she's a judge, just like Ellen Ash Peters was appointed to the Connecticut Supreme Court. So the two of them became judges after being law professors. And actually, I have a friend, colleague here at Santa Clara, Lisa Kloppenberg, who has just written a biography of Dorothy Wright Nelson that will be coming out soon from Oxford University Press.
Wow. So a couple of books out there then about notable women lawyers, law professors. This one is called Paving the Way, The First American Women Law Professors, put together by Herma Hill Kay and finished as editor by Patricia Kane, who's been our guest on The Exchange today. Pat, thanks.
Thank you. All enjoyed right. it.